This is Publishing Talks, the podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Tony Sanfilippo. He's the director of the Ohio State University Press in Columbus, Ohio, but he's also an experienced independent bookseller who used to own and operate a bookstore called Svoboda's, a well-known but lamented bookstore that I guess goes into the category of many bookstores that we know and love that no longer exist. Sorry for that lengthy introduction, Tony. How are you?
I'm good.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about, before we start talking about publishing and books and what you're doing now, maybe talk a little bit about your history. I think you have an unusual path from going from a bookseller to running a scholarly press. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how, you know, your experience in the book business.
Sure. Sometimes I think that this really all relates back to where my parents chose their house. They bought a house when I was a kid on a street called Library Lane, and I think that's probably what first indoctrinated me into this cult. I really ended up loving books. I think because of that experience, I was a bit of a nerd, and being in that library, I spent far much more time in that library than I did hanging out doing normal things that other kids do. And from there, I went actually to my first job at 16 was with Crocs and Brentano's in Chicago. It was a Chicago chain, actually quite a big one. They used to have a store downtown that is bigger than what Powell's is today. And that's what got me into book selling. I worked for both of the chains at the time, Borders. I'd worked for Walden's, and I also worked for B. Dalton when Barnes & Noble had it. And so a couple of other independent bookstores I worked in until I moved to Pennsylvania. I guess it's 30 years ago now. It was a college town. I had gone there with following an ex-wife who had a faculty appointment there, and ended up finding this bookstore, Svoboda Scholarly Books, that had just expanded. It was a tiny little store that really catered to the graduate and faculty community at Penn State. And they got some community investors and increased the store to about a 2,000 foot store. We had probably 10,000 different titles, maybe 25,000 books altogether. We at that store, we when I first went to work there, Michael Svoboda, the founder of the store, was looking for somebody to help, and eventually he, I think, grew tired of bookselling and wanted to finish his degree. He was ABD in philosophy, continental philosophy. So he basically said, look, you can have the store as long as you don't lose all the money. So I ran it for about 10 years. Michael went back to graduate school, ended up getting a job. He's at Washington now, teaching there. And I ran the store for about 10 years. For the final years, we tried keeping the store open by selling textbooks. So I also had quite a bit of experience, at least from the retail end of the textbook market. But that, alas, was not enough. What really became disheartening is we were getting more revenue from the textbooks than we were from the rest of the store. And it was, I think, that factor that really made me think, this isn't worth it. This just doesn't make sense. And it was really doing it on the backs of the students, because as a small independent, we didn't have access to the number of used books that some of the other stores did. So, you know, most of the students were sort of forced to buy new. And I suppose they could have gone to Amazon or gone, to another secondary or used market. But even so, it just didn't seem right. So we ended up closing the store in 2000. I was approached at that time by the Penn State Press, and I went to work for them. And I started as sales manager, became the marketing director, then assistant director of that press. I was there for 15 years. And like I think a lot of disgruntled creative types, I loved what I was doing, but I really wanted to direct. And I was getting offers when positions were opening for positions. So I did start thinking about that next step in my career. And position opened up here in Columbus at Ohio State. Very similar institutions. Both have football teams that distort the reputation of the university. But it was also a program that was relatively healthy. It was a very narrowly focused program, at least on the scholarly side. My predecessor actually gave up trade books pretty much entirely. We had something of a regional list, and he sort of abandoned that portion of the list and really focused on literary studies. When I came here about almost 4 years ago, one of the things I wanted to do was I just really think it's useful for university presses when they're making their case for relevancy and importance to the institution to have a regional program. And it's really for two reasons. One is we do demonstrate our value to the state that way. We're not just publishers of scholarship, arcane scholarship only read by other scholars. We actually can provide books that are useful to the citizens of the state. And monographs are kind of a guaranteed money loser these days. And with universities and the financial situations that they're in, they really don't have more money to help buoy those monograph publishing programs at their university presses. So a trade publishing program is a good way to sort of supplement that revenue so that we can continue to publish important and good scholarship, but scholarship with really a very limited audience and market potential, as they say. So we have a pretty robust regional program here. We also, when I hired an editor-in-chief here, we decided we wanted to have a national trade imprint as well, and we started Mad Creek Books. And that is primarily for creative works, mostly nonfiction. So we're doing quite a few essays there. We've done a couple of memoirs. But we're also, and this is one thing I'm really excited about, we have a series on graphic novels, a series of graphic novels. And the unique approach that we're taking is we're doing it about the Latinx experience. So either Latinx artists and writers or Latinx subject matter. It is, it's one of those areas that's not really being well served by the major publishers, and there's a lot of great content out there, and we wanted to be able to provide a place for that. So it also fits well with our list. We already do quite a bit in Latin American studies, mostly with a focus on literature, and we do quite a bit in cartoon studies. So while those aren't exactly the same, I think, you get in-house expertise on things like how to handle graphics in print, in books, in electronic formats, et cetera. And, it's a way for us, when we were looking at what strengths and weaknesses we had, that certainly seemed to lend itself to doing that particular series and focusing on those particular areas. So that's sort of the logic behind what we've been doing here at Ohio State, and also a bit of a background on how I got here and why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Oh, that's good. And that raises questions gives me entry points for asking questions that I wanted to talk to you about. But one sort of preliminary question is, and I think this sort of, automatically has to be asked. So you're finding that trade book publishing is profitable for you so that you're able to help support the press?
Yes. And I don't recommend this for everybody. I think a lot of folks in scholarly publishing, they certainly understand those markets, that material, the potential of that content and its readership really, really well. I think, in my case, I had this experience with retail, experience on in trade books, much of it on the bookstore side, but that was pretty extensive. So I already knew it was out there in a lot of cases. I knew what our competitors were doing, and I don't know that everybody in university press publishing comes to it with that sort of background. I also lucked out with my editor in chief. One of the first things I did was. My predecessor was both the director and the editor in chief, and really decided, the editorial direction of the press. I certainly want to have a voice in that, but I have this other job I have to do, directing the press itself, and growing that and managing it. We also have a journals program. All of those sorts of things take time. If I was going to increase our program, I knew I couldn't do it by myself. So. I went on the market for an editor-in-chief, and I really lucked out with Kristen Elias Rowley. She, too, actually came from a book-selling background. Her parents had a bookstore, and she grew up in one. And she had worked for University of Nebraska Press before I stole her away. And there, she was actually charged with their trade list, but their trade list was very unusual in that it focused on military history and
baseball.
Sports.
Baseball.
Yeah, sports books. Right, right. Which, are very, very profitable. But, that didn't make sense on our list. So when she came here and she and I first started having discussions about where we wanted to go editorially, we came up with these lists of topics that we thought were important to be discussing. And we also sort of looked at the lay of the land. One of the things that was a factor in deciding to get into trade was what's going on in the larger environment, both with Amazon self-publishing and the consolidation among the bigger publishers. It is very hard these days for mid-list authors, authors who aren't really blockbuster sellers. The trade presses, the Big Five in New York are really much more cautious with those authors than they used to be, which I saw as a market opportunity. And sure enough, we've been able to get some really, really great authors who, in the past might have published with a significantly bigger house. So, it was that factor of, and there were also quite a few people out there who were self-publishing and not happy with that experience, and who, had just chosen the route of self-publishing because it's been difficult for mid-list authors. And again, we saw that as an opportunity. If we could get some good writers, for our smaller press, at something of bargain basement prices, we were going to do that. And thus far we've been very, very lucky. The launch of our Trillium imprint we did with autobiography of Congressman Lewis Stokes, and that sold really, really well. It was a great way to launch that imprint. Then with the Mad Creek imprint we launched with Philip Lopate, his book on his mother. And again, it's very unusual to get somebody of his caliber. But I think the fact that the caution being expressed by the traditional New York publishers really created an opportunity for us there. And even with the graphic novel series, in that case, it wasn't a particular author that we lucked out with when we launched the series. It was really the subject matter. The first book in that series was called Diary of a Reluctant Dreamer, Undocumented Vignettes from a Pre-American Life. And it's about that undocumented experience. And unfortunately, that book has been selling like hotcakes. I mean, unfortunately, that the topic is so, so important and so urgent today. So, again, we were very, very lucky. I think part of that has to do with having both myself and Kristen having experience in a larger book universe. I don't know that I would actually recommend it for every university press, but for us, yes, it's thus far, it's been pretty successful.
Could you maybe talk a little bit more specifically about how your background and your editor's background in trade publishing, in book selling specifically, kind of informs you as a publisher? Because I think that's an important point, but I also think it's hard to, I think people might want to know exactly, you can't talk about it in too much detail, but, just more specifically what you think your experience as a book retailer brings to being a publisher. I think that would be really interesting.
Well, it's really a breadth of exposure. I was looking at what all the other publishers were putting out for 10 years. I was looking at their catalogs. I got a good understanding of their lists. I learned which authors are worth watching and which might be a bit overrated. I learned how, the author-publisher relationship worked sort of by watching what was happening in the larger industry, authors moving from publisher to publisher or authors staying with the same publisher for years and years. So I think it was, knowledge of that broader book universe. Part of it too is related. My wife likes to joke that even though I'm a publisher, I never read, and she makes that joke because I know a lot about a bunch of different books because I read tons of book reviews, and that experience in book selling. But I think, as most booksellers will tell you, obviously they have not read every book in the store. But they need to know something about every book in the store, and that's really, I think, where that comes from is, I had this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of all of the books that were published basically from, 1980 until 2000. And that's really relevant to what I'm doing today and whether or not, those careers of the authors who were being published there went up or down. And where they are now, and again, even the economics and the retail landscape and the changes, that occurred there, those impacted both Kristen's parents' store and my store pretty significantly. And we paid attention to what was going on there and how it was happening. We may not like Amazon, but we certainly understood its power and its reach. In a way that I think is much more to the bone than most publishers have felt. So, it really is, I think, that exposure to a lot of different kinds of literature, not just the canon, but even those who, don't sell a lot, but who are really great writers end up in the New York Review of Books instead of the New York Times Book Review.
Well, and do you think that, being, because when, when you're a retail bookseller, you have direct contact with readers. And I always think that one of the problems that publishers traditionally have is that they focus on the product. They focus on the author and the book because that's the job. The job is to discover new books for people to read, but it's, booksellers have a different orientation. They focus on the customer. Obviously, maybe balancing both because you have to do that. But, they have a sense, an immediate and direct connection with readers. So people come into the store, they tell you what they like. You have a feeling for what things get a person excited. What do you have to tell someone about a book to get them to act, for the light bulb to go off in their head that says, wow, that might be a book I'd like to read. And there's a variation. It's not every person doesn't respond the same way. Booksellers understand this because they're dealing with a range of customers. Publishers have a problem because, at least traditionally, they're disconnected from the retail experience. They don't get to relate directly to a reader that often in a kind of structural way. The Amazon and booksellers and wholesalers and distributors are all between the publisher and the reader. And it makes it kind of, more than complicated in some ways, a huge challenge for a publisher to understand consumers, readers, and then act accordingly. And it seems that maybe I'm kind of reading more into it than I should, but since you have that direct experience of working with retailers, that you kind of, you both codify and can have a kind of mystical, if you will, you know, this sort of, inherent emotional connection with a reader that it would be more difficult for someone who doesn't have your experience to understand. And maybe you could tell me whether I'm wrong about that.
No. I absolutely agree. I mean, it's a matter of having that experience with consumer. You know, I hate to get so clinical about it, but it's consumer behavior. The way people buy books is different than how they buy socks or, you know, any other kind of product. And the way, the importance of word of mouth, the way referral works, all of those things in a bookstore are definitely, I think, do inform some of our publishing decisions. And of course, what's really changed is I don't think those behaviors work quite the same when you're shopping online. I actually do think publishers think about that, because at least in that case, in some cases, they are getting some data back. You know, certainly on their own websites, they can watch how consumers are behaving on their websites and what they're looking at, how long they're spending in places, and where they may eventually, pull the trigger for a purchase. Obviously, the aggregator of the largest amount of that data right now is Amazon, and they don't share it willingly. You know, I mean, they do sell some of that data to publishers if you can afford it. But they, you know, and generally that's just behavior around their own books. But to, you know, Amazon right now, I think, has such a significant advantage because they do have all that information about how people buy books online, and are clearly experts at it. And that is also a factor that I think we as publishers need to think about, too. There's sort of a debate that has raged at both presses I've worked at about what's happening to book covers, for example. It used to be that the fonts on book covers were a lot smaller because they didn't have to be so big, because they didn't have to be read as a thumbnail. And the thumbnail itself, I think, is having a huge impact on book design.
Yep.
Titles are getting larger and larger, and, you know, images have to be more and more striking. So I don't know that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's certainly something I've noticed in the transition between the majority of books being bought at brick and mortar retailers and now the majority of books being bought online. It's not something I particularly like. Oftentimes when we get, when a discussion happens here at the press, we will default to the importance of the aesthetic of the physical book as opposed to how it might read online. So it may be in a couple of cases we've gone the other way there, but generally we tend to be book fetishists like others in publishing and really try to design for the physical object as opposed to its digital representation. So yeah, it's, knowing about consumer behavior, particularly around books, doesn't hurt Kristen and I. I think that is really a valuable asset that we bring to the game.
And do you also then... And is this possible for you as a publisher to engage in direct to consumer activities to supplement what you do in book trade venues? You mentioned that you do the built the regional book series at Ohio State, and that would seem to lead more directly by itself to relating to consumer, to actual readers, not just
absolutely,
to resellers.
That's very true. I mean, and you know, to a certain extent, the winnowing of the bookstore landscape has actually served us here, because if a state like Ohio is a pretty big state, and most of that list is going to sell relatively well anywhere in the state. The thing is, you know, how do you reach all of those bookstores? Well, you know, when you're down to about seven of them, your job gets a lot easier. You know, if you take Barnes & Noble out of the equation, you know, as far as independents here in Ohio that sell new books, number one, have a regional section or, think that they have the ability to sell to a regional audience, you know, by the time we're done, we're really talking about having to service 7 accounts here in Ohio. So that's not a hard thing to do. The great thing about that is it gets us into bookstores, it gets us back into booksellers. And you know, I do a lot of that myself, part of it probably nostalgia. But part of it also because I'm very sympathetic to their challenges and I really want to work for them, make it as profitable as possible to carry our books. So, you know, I don't dictate to them how much I think they ought to carry or which titles that they should carry. What I really want to do is try to figure out ways of making their life easier. Do you just order from Ingram? I'll make sure we've got inventory at Ingram. Do you want to order from us? Do you want to have an author event? It really is for that part of the list, a very relationship driven and personal kind of pitch. So yes, absolutely. The regional list is incredibly dependent on bookstores. Here in Columbus, we've got a pretty good crop. We just lost one, unfortunately, but we also gained one last year. So I guess all in all, we're still at the same number. But we have great relationships with all of the local booksellers here, and yeah, they're definitely helpful, and they are they're absolutely a requirement for a regional list. Although I will say, I have a colleague up in Cleveland, Ann Trubeck, who runs Belt Publishing, and she has done, I think, a fantastic job. It's not that she doesn't service bookstores in quite the same way we do. It's just that she actually, I think, does much better online than she does with bookstores. And I think part of that is just she's got a great editorial eye, and she's picked some real winners. But part of that is she actually is, I think, very good at exploiting online promotion and publicity. And if that's where you're doing, the majority of your marketing, then it only makes sense that the majority of your sales are probably going to be online as well. So I don't think that the way we do it here is the only way to do it. And I'm really trying to learn from Anne how to better sell a regional list online. Outside of the things that I don't have any control over, Amazon, what things do we have control over, and how do we market, and how do we, get the information out to consumers? And when these days, all anybody wants is a filter from that sort of thing. So, really trying to figure out how do you get attention, how do you effectively promote online? That's something that I'm fascinated with, and I still have more to learn about.
Do you feel that it's a possibility for publishers to find a way to sell directly to readers themselves without upsetting the rest of the ecosystem? That seems to me a big challenge, but also something that it's almost crucial for publishers to think about now. You mentioned that there are only 7 bookstores in the state of Ohio. To me, I don't mean that there are only 7 altogether, but 7 that you can work with on a significant level. To me, that's almost stunning because, there are millions of people in Ohio. And yes, there's Barnes & Noble. And yes, there's Amazon. But we have, and there probably are a large number of places like museums and archaeological sites with gift shops and parks that have stores, that could sell maybe some of your regional books. But if we, kind of feel like the number of retail outlets is declining, the online experience is not universal. It doesn't, not every single person that doesn't go into a bookstore ends up going to buy books from Amazon. I think that we know that. So is it possible? Is it even feasible for a publisher of your size and of your kind of range of interests to find a way to supplement the current environment? I don't mean replace it necessarily because you don't want your bookstores to get mad and go home. But can you figure it out? Is there a way to do that?
It's a great, great question, and it's something I know some people who I really respect, like Joe Esposito, is really trying to figure out is how do we do better direct to consumer, and how do we leverage our websites to do that. I want to do that. You know, I don't want to come across as if I don't think that's worth pursuing. But I will say that there is a huge, huge challenge in doing that, in that an imprint or a publisher doesn't mean a thing to the consumer. Nobody buys books based on the publisher or the imprint. They buy the books based on the author and the content. So if what you're talking about is trying to attract consumers to a brand, well, if they don't even consider the publisher a brand, you're really stuck at the gate there. So, you know, while I think that's, you know, there's so many reasons for trying to go after that direct-to-consumer market. You know, you cut out all the middlemen, the margins are going to be higher. It just makes a lot of sense to make that effort. On the other hand, what you're really trying to do is the impossible, and that is to try to create an audience around a publisher. And I think in some cases that does make sense. You know, for example, Copper Canyon and literary books. And, you know, I think there are some publishers that have an audience, but it tends to be because they're highly specialized in one particular thing. So everybody who's also interested in that particular thing is going to be circling around that publisher because that's where all the good stuff's coming from. But I think, you know, to go out there and try to say, I'm going to brand Mad Creek or Trillium or the Ohio State University Press and make it a destination point, that is a very, very difficult thing to do because in the consumer's mind, you're not the destination point for books. It's Amazon is the destination point for books or a bookstore. You know, frankly, I see a lot of value in the publisher's name and the imprints in what we do, but it's on the other side. Those are important to authors. That's who's paying attention to that branding. And a lot of times we will run ads and I'll say, look, I know this is an expensive ad. The point is not to run this ad to recover its cost in sales. The point is to point out to reviewers this cool stuff that we're doing, because reviewers read other reviewers and authors who are another big audience of ours. You know, hey, they got a book with Philip Lopate. Maybe I should check them out. You know, so it, for me, when I look at the idea of branding and should I focus on getting consumers to recognize that brand so that they will, purchase from us directly. Is that really the best use of that brand? Or is it to make that brand, something that gets the attention of agents and authors and reviewers and bookstores? That seems to me to be a better way to publicize, or a more effective use of the publicizing of the brand.
Okay, fair enough. I think I'm not trying to tell you how to run your business, more just trying to ask, how it.
Sure. And the funny thing is, on the other side of that, so I used to sell textbooks. Now I actually publish one. We have one book that we published that actually, sells into the tens of thousands, and it's a linguistics textbook. Now, that book, on the other hand, we do see a ton of direct-to-consumer sales. One reason is the Kindle renders that book terribly. There are so many diacritics and strange little characters and such that the Kindle, we are constantly trying to track down why did that character render that way. Meanwhile, on our own site, we sell a PDF of that book, and the PDF is flawless. It looks exactly like the physical book. There aren't those problems. So a ton of them actually sell from our site. I was really astonished at the number of direct sales that we have just on that book. And again, I think, well, part of it is that the product is better from us than it is from Amazon, which is, I guess, probably unusual. But the other part of it, too, is that book is highly adopted here at Ohio State. So the department is already telling them, go to the Ohio State Press department or the Ohio State website and Ohio State Press website and buy the book. And we actually give them a discount code to do that. So, you know, that to me is a much easier way to sort of see some increases in direct consumer. It wasn't even something we intended to do, but we just got, after our second year of this textbook being an ebook, I looked at that direct consumer number, and it was, of the ebooks, it was about 30% of the ebooks that sold were direct consumer from our site. And that's insane.
No, that's very
unusual. Nobody sees those kinds of direct consumer numbers.
Very unusual. Now, what makes me immediately think, maybe it does you too, well, there's an opportunity maybe to grow a business in publishing books that are not easily converted to kind of traditional ebook forms. And of course, that does get us into an interesting point, and that is illustrated books, which, you know, there's been some discussion about. Ebooks have not successfully managed how to do illustrated books, at least in my opinion. And I think that's probably widely shared. You see mostly illustrated books end up being published in print. And if you think about, you know, some of the challenges for a book that is, let's say, 9x12 or 8x10, the screen size of an e-reader does not lend itself very well to viewing these large portrait style pages or, you know, large children's book pages, or even in some cases, graphic novels, although there have been, I think, fairly considerably good versions of reading for graphic novels that have not, there is no trade equivalent to that. My lengthy run-up there is, do you think that maybe there's an opportunity to do PDF? I haven't really thought about this before. Could you do PDF ebooks of books that would not work in an EPUB or Kindle format? And a publisher could then sell those. That's like a pretty radical thought. And maybe there are lots of other publishers who have figured that out, and it's just something I've never heard of before.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's the old flowable text versus fixed text issue.
Right,
and
right.
Our graphic novels, we don't even try to sell them on Kindle because, for example, that the one I spoke about earlier, Diary of a Reluctant Dreamer, that's a landscape book. Kindle does not give you the opportunity to do, and a lot of the pages are the full page illustration, so you can't break it up. So yeah, on your normal portrait landscape ratio, that book is unreadable. So perhaps, and like I said, we didn't even try. If that wasn't our first graphic novel, we actually just published with IDW a book of scholarship that's also in comics form. And again, no, there's no point in doing an ebook on this because it doesn't flow. It doesn't make sense. Each page is composed very deliberately. And if we were, you know, if you're going to do comics, you really have to, I think, modify the design if you think the primary market is Kindle. You have to impose, strictures on the artist up front before they've done the first page so that they know that, you know, that thing is going to be able to be legible on a Kindle device or on a mobile device. So, absolutely. I do think that there's an opportunity there for selling fixed ebooks. And Apple has made some has tried some experiments with this. And they do have, I think, better tools for ebook construction that do allow for more flexibility. What with still flowing text, but at least with anchors on a page, for example, so that images aren't floating all over the place and in unpredictable ways. The thing about comics and graphic novels, though, is I think there is a materiality issue there. I think that they have been so traditionally tied to paper and print and you know, everything from, you know, daily newspaper comic strips to the comic books themselves to even the early graphic novels. I think they were all such physical objects first and, you know, just content second. And I think that audience anyway is still much more enamored with having the object than having just the content digitally. So
I will give you a yes, but, and this is what
and
I think this has to do with younger readers, manga in particular. I would look at manga and say it is the equivalent in graphic novels and comics to romance novels are in trade publishing. And that is they're highly consumed in series form. And for those people who are really dedicated manga readers, the $12.95 price point for a paperback is problematical. And especially if they're kids, which a lot of them are. So I actually think that category may be the exception to your posit that print is actually preferred for graphic novels and illustrated kind of storytelling, because I think you're right. The digital tools that enable reading on screens are not really good for what we look at in terms of illustrated storytelling.
Yeah, I agree. The one thing I would say about the manga issue is I think you're absolutely right that more manga, especially in Japan and Korea, is consumed electronically than it is in print. But I would add to that the caveat that those audiences tend to be adult. They're not kids. I think that you're talking about people who are reading while they're on the train or reading while they're waiting in line for something, and to be able to pull out your phone and continue in that series that you're, you know, so absorbed by. I think that's happening much more with older
readers. In Japan and Korea, I agree. But I think in America, there's an opening there. I just don't think that we don't have visibility to it. I think it's really hard to understand,
right.
You know, to kind of even know what's going on with reading of manga and, you know, graphic novels. Just there's hard to get data. And you know, some of what I'm saying is kind of posited based on, you know, kind of anecdata rather than real data. You know, it's hard to know for sure.
My kids are big comic readers, and they will not read a comic on their phone or on an electronic device. They insist on print. They're probably not normal kids because I'm their dad, and I make books for a living. But yeah, they at least certainly buck the electronic trend. On the other hand, you know, and comics are as varied as I think other elements in publishing. If you're talking about the superhero universes, those guys have done, I think, a dynamite job at creating apps that, make their content available digitally in a really, I think, engaging and post-print kind of way. But, you know, if you look at the kinds of comics that I'm interested in, a lot of those don't translate very well electronically. So, for example, my favorite book last year was My Favorite Thing is Monsters, and that was published by Fantagraphics, and it's huge. If you ever see it in a bookstore, it looks like a phone book. That book, that experience just, I can't imagine it working digitally. The comic itself, it's written as if it were the journal of this young girl, and it has everything from even the lines and the paper behind her doodlings, which is what actually makes up the comics. So, you know, it is a very physically referential thing. At least that particular book was, and I think that's true with a lot of really hot people in the graphic novel area, Alison Bechdel, for example. I don't think that's going to translate as well electronically. I think, I could go on and on with examples, but the comics world isn't a monolithic, and there, you know, every time you think you've figured something out, you find another branch of comics where things are handled differently and actually better, you know, than other particular areas. But I also, you know, as a publisher of this material myself, one thing that I really want to be cognizant of is I don't want, you know, these formats to be dictating things to the artists, you know, and I think that's fine for Batman and Superman. You know, those are major corporations that are clearly have a very different agenda about what comics are and what comics mean than I do. But from my perspective, I'm not going to tell an artist, go back to the drawing board and split this up into four pages so that I can get it into something that'll scroll instead of pages that people can turn. It just, to me, that seems like a constraint that you would be putting on the artist that would be artificial and would harm their work.
Well, Chris, you could argue that the newspaper format dictated the way cartoons worked, you know, in strips.
Yeah, the strip, sure.
And paperback books dictated the way, or magazines, you know, dictated, or like the printing technology dictated the way the size of comic books, you know, that those are really
right.
Based on the what's an ideal page
paper
size.
Paper rolls,
yeah,
size. And,
yeah,
yeah,
right. So the physical constraints have always been there in a certain way. But I understand what you're saying. You know, it's kind of there are constraints that are based on a kind of macro technology environment and not necessarily, you know, idiosyncratic to the publisher.
Right. And maybe the difference is, you know, the kind of comics those were meant to be sort of ephemeral and not serious. And really what I'm trying to emphasize here is the artists we want to work with, we want to consider, you know, we think of them as you know, very much independent artists, and what's important there is the art, not necessarily the serial nature of the storytelling.
Right. No, that makes sense. Well, I really I want to thank you for taking the time, because I know you're busy, but I really appreciate, you know, kind of the kind of broad ranging conversation that we've had. I want to thank you for doing this.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun. The funny thing is, you know, the one thing we hardly talked about at all is the main part of my job, which is the monographs. But
well, and that may, and that
to be
may,
honest, that's the least interesting part of my job to a certain extent. So,
well, I don't think it's unimportant or even uninteresting, but it probably reflects to a certain extent my bias, maybe yours, of the things that are, you know, kind of where is the energy and the excitement. But I think that publishing, scholarly publishing, is really threatened and really important. And I, you know, maybe that we'll have to save that for another conversation.
Sounds good.
All right.
Be happy to do it.
Well, thanks, Tony. This has been Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Tony Sanfilippo of the Ohio State University Press. I'm David Wilk, your host.